Chapter 159. Retribution. Changes have come again upon the great house in the long dull street, once the scene of Florence's childhood and loneliness. It is a great house still, proof against wind and weather, without breaches in the roof, or shattered windows, or dilapidated walls, but it is a ruin nonetheless, and the rats fly from it. Mr. Towlinson and company are, at first, incredulous in respect of the shapeless rumors that they hear. Cook says our people's credit ain't so easy shook as that comes to, thank God. And Mr. Towlinson expects to hear it reported next, that the Bank of England's a going to break, or the jewels in the tower to be sold up. But, next come the Gazette, and Mr. Perch. And Mr. Perch brings Mrs. Perch, to talk it over in the kitchen, and to spend a pleasant evening. As soon as there is no doubt about it, Mr. Towlinson's main anxiety is that the failure should be a good round one, not less than £100,000. Mr. Perch don't think himself that £100,000 will nearly cover it. The women, led by Mrs. Perch and Cook, often repeat £100,000. ... with awful satisfaction, as if handling the words were like handling the money, and the housemaid, who has her eye on Mr. Towlinson, wishes she had only a hundredth part of the sum to bestow on the man of her choice. Mr. Towlinson, still mindful of his old wrong, opines that a foreigner would hardly know what to do with so much money unless he spent it on his whiskers, which bitter sarcasm causes the housemaid to withdraw in tears, but not to remain long absent. For Cook, who has the reputation of being extremely good-hearted, says, whatever they do, let them stand by one another now, Towlinson, for there's no telling how soon they may be divided. They have been in that house, says Cook, through a funeral, a wedding, and a running away, and let it not be said that they couldn't agree among themselves at such a time as the present. Mrs. Perch is immensely affected by this moving address, and openly remarks that Cook is an angel. Mr. Towlinson replies to Cook, far be it from him to stand in the way of that good feeling which he could wish to see, and adjourning in quest of the housemaid, and presently returning with that young lady on his arm, informs the kitchen that foreigners is only his fun, and that him and Anne have now resolved to take one another for better for worse, and to settle in Oxford Market in the General Greengrocery and Herb and Leech line, where your kind favors is particular requested. This announcement is received with acclamation, and Mrs. Perch, projecting her soul into futurity, says, girls, ... in Cook's ear, in a solemn whisper. Misfortune in the family without feasting, in these lower regions, couldn't be. Therefore Cook tosses up a hot dish or two for supper, and Mr. Towlinson compounds a lobster salad, to be devoted to the same hospitable purpose. Even Mrs. Pipchin, agitated by the occasion, rings her bell, and sends down word that she requests to have that little bit of sweetbread that was left, warmed up for her supper, and sent to her on a tray with about a quarter of a tumbler full of mulled sherry, for she feels poorly. There is a little talk about Mr. Dombey, but very little. It is chiefly speculation as to how long he has known that this was going to happen. Cook says shrewdly, oh, a long time, bless you. Take your oath of that. ... and reference being made to Mr. Perch, he confirms her view of the case. Somebody wonders what he'll do, and whether he'll go out in any situation. Mr. Towlinson thinks not, and hints at a refuge in one of them genteel almshouses of the better kind. Ah, where he'll have his little garden, you know, ... says Cook plaintively, and bring up sweet peas in the spring. ... exactly so, ... says Mr. Towlinson, and be one of the brethren of something or another. ... we are all brethren, ... says Mrs. Perch, in a pause of her drink. Except the sisters, ... says Mr. Perch. How are the mighty fallen? ... remarks Cook. Pride shall have a fall, and it always was and will be so. ... observes the housemaid. It is wonderful how good they feel in making these reflections, and what a Christian unanimity they are sensible of in bearing the common shock with resignation. There is only one interruption to this excellent state of mind, which is occasioned by a young kitchen maid of inferior rank in black stockings who, having sat with her mouth open for a long time, unexpectedly discharges from it words to this effect, "Suppose the wages shouldn't be paid." The company sit for a moment speechless, but cook, recovering first, turns upon the young woman, and requests to know how she dares insult the family, whose bread she eats, by such a dishonest supposition, and whether she thinks that anybody, with a scrap of honor left, could deprive poor servants of their pittance? "Because if that is your religious feelings, Mary Dawes," says cook warmly, "I don't know where you mean to go to. Mr. Towlinson don't know either, nor anybody." And the young kitchen maid, appearing not to know exactly herself, and scouted by the general voice, is covered with confusion, as with a garment. After a few days, strange people begin to call at the house, and to make appointments with one another in the dining room, as if they lived there. Especially, there is a gentleman, of a Mosaic Arabian cast of countenance, with a very massive watch guard, who whistles in the drawing room, and, while he is waiting for the other gentleman, who always has pen and ink in his pocket, asks Mr. Towlinson, by the easy name of Old Cock, if he happens to know what the figure of them crimson and gold hangings might have been, when new bought. The callers and appointments in the dining room become more numerous every day, and every gentleman seems to have pen and ink in his pocket, and to have some occasion to use it. At last it is said, that there is going to be a sale, and then more people arrive, with pen and ink in their pockets, commanding a detachment of men with carpet caps, who immediately begin to pull up the carpets, and knock the furniture about, and to print off thousands of impressions of their shoes upon the hall and staircase. The council downstairs are in full conclave all this time, and, having nothing to do, perform perfect feats of eating. At length, they are one day summoned in a body to Mrs. Pipchin's room, and thus addressed by the fair Peruvian. "Your master's in difficulties," says Mrs. Pipchin, tartly. "You know that, I suppose?" Mr. Towlinson, as spokesman, admits a general knowledge of the fact. "And you're all on the lookout for yourselves, I warrant you," says Mrs. Pipchin, shaking her head at them. A shrill voice from the rear exclaims, "No more than yourself." "That's your opinion, Mrs. Impudence, is it?" Says the ireful Pipchin, looking with a fiery eye over the intermediate heads. "Yes, Mrs. Pipchin, it is," replies cook, advancing. "And what then, pray?" "Why, then you may go, as soon as you like," says Mrs. Pipchin. "The sooner the better, and I hope I shall never see your face again." With this the doughty Pipchin produces a canvas bag, and tells her wages out to that day, and a month beyond it, and clutches the money tight, until a receipt for the same is duly signed, to the last upstroke, when she grudgingly lets it go. This form of proceeding Mrs. Pipchin repeats with every member of the household, until all are paid. "Now those that choose, can go about their business," says Mrs. Pipchin, "and those that choose, can stay here on board wages for a week or so, and make themselves useful. Except," says the inflammable Pipchin, "that slut of a cook, who'll go immediately." Says cook, "she certainly will. I wish you good day, Mrs. Pipchin, and sincerely wish I could compliment you on the sweetness of your appearance." "Get along with you," says Mrs. Pipchin, stamping her foot. Cook sails off with an air of beneficent dignity, highly exasperating to Mrs. Pipchin, and is shortly joined below stairs by the rest of the confederation. Mr. Towlinson then says that, in the first place, he would beg to propose a little snack of something to eat, and over that snack would desire to offer a suggestion which he thinks will meet the position in which they find themselves. The refreshment being produced, and very heartily partaken of, Mr. Towlinson's suggestion is, in effect, that Cook is going, and that if we are not true to ourselves, nobody will be true to us. That they have lived in that house a long time, and exerted themselves very much to be sociable together. At this, Cook says, with emotion, "Here, here." And Mrs. Perch, who is there again, and full to the throat, sheds tears. And that he thinks, at the present time, the feeling ought to be go one, go all. The housemaid is much affected by this generous sentiment, and warmly seconds it. Cook says she feels it's right, and only hopes it's not done as a compliment to her, but from a sense of duty. Mr. Towlinson replies, from a sense of duty, and that now he is driven to express his opinions, he will openly say, that he does not think it over respectable to remain in a house, where sales and such like are carrying forwards. The housemaid is sure of it, and relates, in confirmation, that a strange man, in a carpet cap, offered, this very morning, to kiss her on the stairs. Hereupon, Mr. Towlinson is starting from his chair, to seek and smash the offender, when he is laid hold on by the ladies, who beseech him to calm himself, and to reflect, that it is easier and wiser to leave the scene of such indecencies at once. Mrs. Perch, presenting the case in a new light, even shows that delicacy towards Mr. Dombey, shut up in his own rooms, imperatively demands precipitate retreat. For what, says the good woman, must his feelings be, if he was to come upon any of the poor servants, that he once deceived into thinking him immensely rich? Cook is so struck by this moral consideration, that Mrs. Perch proves it with several pious axioms, original and selected. It becomes a clear case, that they must all go. Boxes are packed, caps fetched, and at dusk, that evening there is not one member of the party left. The house stands, large and weatherproof, in the long dull street, but it is a ruin, and the rats fly from it. The men in the carpet caps go on tumbling the furniture about, and the gentlemen with the pens and ink make out inventories of it, and sit upon pieces of furniture never made to be sat upon, and eat bread and cheese from the public house on other pieces of furniture never made to be eaten on, and seem to have a delight in appropriating precious articles to strange uses. Chaotic combinations of furniture also take place. Mattresses and bedding appear in the dining room. The glass and china get into the conservatory. The great dinner service is set out in heaps on the long divan in the large drawing room, and the stair wires, made in two fasces, decorate the marble chimney pieces. Finally, a rug, with a printed bill upon it, is hung out from the balcony, and a similar appendage graces either side of the hall door. Then, all day long, there is a retinue of moldy gigs, and chaise carts in the street, and herds of shabby vampires, Jew and Christian, overrun the house, sounding the plate glass miners with their knuckles, striking discordant octaves on the grand piano, drawing wet forefingers over the pictures, breathing on the blades of the best dinner knives, punching the squabs of chairs and sofas with their dirty fists, tousling the feather beds, opening and shutting all the drawers, balancing the silver spoons and forks, looking into the very threads of the drapery and linen, and disparaging everything. There is not a secret place in the whole house. Fluffy and snuffy strangers stare into the kitchen range as curiously as into the attic clothes press. Stout men with napless hats on look out of the bedroom windows and cut jokes with friends in the street. Quiet, calculating spirits withdraw into the dressing rooms with catalogues, and make marginal notes thereon, with stumps of pencils. Two brokers invade the very fire escape, and take a panoramic survey of the neighborhood from the top of the house. The swarm and buzz, and going up and down, endure 4 days. The capital modern household furniture, and see, is on view. Then there is a palisade of tables made in the best drawing room, and on the capital, French polished, extending, telescopic range of Spanish mahogany dining tables with turned legs, the pulpit of the auctioneer is erected, and the herds of shabby vampires, Jew and Christian, the strangers fluffy and snuffy, and the stout men with the napless hats, congregate about it, and sit upon everything within reach, mantelpieces included, and begin to bid. Hot, humming, and moldy are the rooms all day, and high above the heat, hum, and dust the head and shoulders, voice and hammer, of the auctioneer, are ever at work. The men in the carpet caps get flustered, and vicious with tumbling the lots about, and still the lots are going, going, gone, still coming on. Sometimes there is joking, and a general roar. This lasts all day and 3 days following. The capital modern household furniture, and see is on sale. Then the moldy gigs and chaise carts reappear, and with them come spring vans and wagons, and an army of porters with knots. All day long, the men with carpet caps are screwing at screwdrivers and bed winches, or staggering by the dozen together on the staircase under heavy burdens, or upheaving perfect rocks of Spanish mahogany, best rosewood, or plate glass, into the gigs and chaise carts, vans and wagons. All sorts of vehicles of burden are in attendance, from a tilted wagon to a wheelbarrow. Poor Paul's little bedstead is carried off in a donkey tandem. For nearly a whole week, the capital modern household furniture, and see, is in course of removal. At last it is all gone. Nothing is left about the house, but scattered leaves of catalogues, littered scraps of straw and hay, and a battery of pewter pots behind the hall door. The men with the carpet caps gather up their screwdrivers, and bed winches in two bags, shoulder them, and walk off. One of the pen and ink gentlemen goes over the house as a last attention, sticking up bills in the windows respecting the lease of this desirable family mansion, and shutting the shutters. At length he follows the men with the carpet caps. None of the invaders remain. The house is a ruin, and the rats fly from it. Mrs. Pipchin's apartments, together with those locked rooms on the ground floor, where the window blinds are drawn down close, have been spared the general devastation. Mrs. Pipchin has remained austere and stony during the proceedings, in her own room, or has occasionally looked in at the sale, to see what the goods are fetching, and to bid for one particular easy chair. Mrs. Pipchin has been the highest bidder for the easy chair, and sits upon her property when Mrs. Chick comes to see her. How is my brother, Mrs. Pipchin? Says Mrs. Chick. I don't know any more than the deuce, says Mrs. Pipchin. He never does me the honor to speak to me. He has his meat and drink put in the next room to his own, and what he takes, he comes out and takes when there's nobody there. It's no use asking me. I know no more about him than the man in the South who burnt his mouth by eating cold plum porridge. This the acrimonious Pipchin says with a flounce. But good gracious me! Cries Mrs. Chick blandly. How long is this to last? If my brother will not make an effort, Mrs. Pipchin, what is to become of him? I am sure I should have thought he had seen enough of the consequences of not making an effort, by this time, to be warned against that fatal error. Says Mrs. Pipchin, rubbing her nose. There's a great fuss, I think, about it. It ain't so wonderful a case. People have had misfortunes before now, and been obliged to part with their furniture. I'm sure I have. My brother, pursues Mrs. Chick profoundly, is so peculiar, so strange a man. He is the most peculiar man I ever saw. Would anyone believe that, when he received news of the marriage and emigration of that unnatural child, it's a comfort to me now to remember that I always said there was something extraordinary about that child. But nobody minds me what anybody believe. I say that he should then turn round upon me, and say he had supposed, from my manner, that she had come to my house? Why, my gracious! And would anybody believe that, when I merely say to him, Paul, I may be very foolish, and I have no doubt I am, but I cannot understand how your affairs can have got into this state, he should actually fly at me, and request that I will. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.